Think on your feet for our Fast and Curious 5K, a one-of-a-kind race hosted by WBEZ and the Chicago Sun-Times on Saturday, July 27th at Humboldt Park. More info and early bird registration at WBEZ.org/events.
This is Reset. I'm Susie Ahn. The coronavirus pandemic only seems to be getting worse as we get closer to winter. On Wednesday, CDC Director Robert Redfield said he expects December, January, and February to be, quote, the most difficult time in the public health history of this nation. So far this week, the numbers seem to match his sentiment. The U.S. reported more than 2,800 deaths from COVID-19 yesterday and the day before. That's close to the number of Americans who lost their lives on 9/11, but it's happening every day. There's positive news, too. Vaccines are closer than ever. Chicago is expecting local healthcare workers and other at-risk individuals to receive doses in the next couple of weeks. Here with the latest on the pandemic is Dr. Mia Taramina. She is an infectious disease specialist with the DuPage Medical Group. Dr. Taramina, welcome back to Reset.
Hey, Susie.
First, what's your reaction to that statement from CDC Director Redfield and how many cases and deaths we're seeing on a daily basis this week?
Yeah, it's truly impressive statistics and sad and heartbreaking. You know, along the way here, we've had some naysayers liken the coronavirus to the flu. And just to put things into perspective, we had a day this week in the United States where we lost more people in a single day than we have in the last 5 years of influenza in the U.S. combined. So this is not the flu. And make no mistake, we have a very serious virus and we have some hope on the horizon, but we are indeed in the thick of a surge that is going to be lasting, I am in agreement, until January, February.
Well, yeah, you mentioned that bit of hope. The UK just authorized the Pfizer vaccine and is planning to start distributing it next week. When do you think we'll see the same announcement here in the US?
We're close behind. The FDA is meeting on the 10th, and we should be able to get some distribution shortly thereafter, presuming that emergency use authorization is granted. The Moderna vaccine is right on its coattails, and I think their meeting is scheduled either the 17th or perhaps the 20th, but very soon afterward, they're going to be meeting to apply for emergency use authorization as well. And hopefully, we will be looking at the possibility of two vaccines being distributed at least to our frontline workers by the end of the year.
Right. And the CDC made its recommendations for who should get vaccinated first. That's pretty much in line with what the Chicago Department of Public Health also planned out, which would be healthcare workers and people in congregate living environments who would be the first to get the vaccination. Will this significantly slow down the spread or should we not expect any major changes until everyone can take the vaccine?
I think that every single person that we are able to vaccinate, even starting with the most vulnerable and with our frontline workers, is going to have some trickle-down effect. We become less likely to be holding on to this virus and spreading it in the communities as we go out and about for necessary activities as well. You know, when we talk about nursing home patients and our most vulnerable, vaccinating a large population like that is going to decrease these outbreaks and decrease the potential lateral spread to nursing home workers and facility workers, and we are going to start to see this, which is why once we get to the point of being able to vaccinate the rest of our healthy adult population, we will be able to protect our kids who are not yet going to be approved for vaccine for some time. Mm-hmm. So we need to continue to move towards that essential herd immunity concept by vaccinating as many people as possible and diluting the ability to infect other people based on how many people we can vaccinate.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've got a question from Patricia in Glenview. Patricia, what's on your mind?
I'm just wondering about whether once the vaccine is available, if people who already have the antibodies, in other words, may have had the virus and become asymptomatic, is there a problem if they then get the vaccine? In other words, can you get an antibody overdose or do you test for antibodies before you would give the vaccine?
Dr. Taramina?
That's a great question, Patricia, and there's a lot more data to come on that. The current recommendation, I believe, and we will again have to wait for the official recommendations, is going to be that everyone who's had coronavirus and does have antibodies does indeed receive vaccine as well. We do not see any issues with quote-unquote overdosing on antibodies. That's not going to be something that happens with the way these vaccines work. However, we don't know what the reliability is with natural immunity and how long those natural antibodies are protective. And we do know that what we are able to generate in terms of neutralizing antibodies with these vaccines should be more durable for a longer period of time. In addition to being able to check antibodies, we're eventually going to need a greater capacity to check antibody titers. And it's going to take some time to sort of see what is that level that is going to be necessary to maintain in order to render protection, or at least some protection. And then we'll be able to figure out when booster doses may be necessary.
Good question. Yeah, I've heard a bit about side effects as well with the vaccine. For folks who could be vaccinated soon, what might they expect in terms of side effects?
So the challenge here is going to be that, yes, the vaccine could cause some uncomfortable side effects. The statistics that have been released by the Pfizer vaccine are less than 5% with body aches, sort of flu-like symptoms, maybe some headache. And in that, we're looking at about 24 hours of feeling uncomfortable. And that's just going to be in some individuals. Because this is a two-dose vaccine, what we really want to avoid is someone having some uncomfortable side effects for a day, not wanting that second dose. That isn't going to achieve the end goal here. So, you know, to the extent that we can use some rest, Tylenol, hydration, and get over the hump of some mild side effects, this is not going to be a vaccine that is too much unlike all the other vaccines that are on the market in their potential to cause a day of some discomfort.
Now, some Americans out there are opposed to just vaccines in general. They worry about taking a vaccine. What do you say to those folks who may find vaccines dubious?
You know, it's such a challenge. Fortunately, the enthusiasm I am seeing for this coronavirus vaccine has been tremendous. So I'm hoping that we have a significant portion of the population that is ready and willing. The first two vaccines coming to market use a slightly different technology than vaccines we've had previously. And some of the concerns over the safety of vaccines have historically come from live vaccines or modified attenuated vaccines. And getting down to using a vaccine that's really at the level of the molecular level, the RNA, is going to really minimize the side effects and the potential concerns that people have from some of these vaccines. I believe that this is some of the safest technology in vaccines that's ever come to market. This is something that was being worked on even prior to coronavirus, and it's extremely exciting to have such an efficacious vaccine with a tremendous safety profile being released at this point, you know, so soon on in the pandemic. I'm very excited to receive it myself.
That's Dr. Mia Taramina. She's an infectious disease specialist with the DuPage Medical Group, and she's answering your questions about how to stay safe with COVID-19 during this pandemic. We've got Nancy in Edgewater with a question. Nancy?
My question is, let's say I get both shots of the vaccine, and I'm safe, but can I still be a carrier? Can I travel? And am I a... Can I infect other people?
Yeah, Nancy, exactly as we were saying, there should be much less of a chance for someone who is fully vaccinated to be able to carry live virus. It's not impossible, though, because everyone is going to boost an immune response that's slightly different, and we don't have enough information just yet to know exactly how much immunity you have and how likely you are going to be to still be able to hold on to any active virus. So that's why until we have enough of this population vaccinated, so we know that the folks that you're in close proximity to have also received vaccine, and it again makes it much less likely for transmission to occur, and we can truly definitively break this cycle, we are still going to be wearing our masks and washing our hands and keeping that social distancing even after we are vaccinated. So there is certainly going to be some level of reassurance, but no 100% guarantees.
Thanks so much, Nancy. And we're going to go now to Nikki in Irving Park. Nikki, you have a question for the doctor?
Yes. Hi, Dr. Taramina. So now that we're past Thanksgiving and we saw how testing was sort of overwhelmed, and now that the CDC has shortened the quarantine guidelines, do you think that there are safe ways for families to gather for the winter holidays?
Sure. So my preference is still going to be to adhere to the recommendations that we don't travel and we don't gather in large groups. I think that to the extent you're able to reimagine any holiday gatherings for the remainder of the year through using Zoom or FaceTime or other modalities is going to be preferred. But the CDC is now recommending testing both before and after any travel out of an abundance of caution. This is not something that is going to be a free pass. But to the extent that we are trying to be as safe as possible, getting a test around 72 hours before travel and then getting tested around 5 to 7 days after return is going to be something that is advisable by the CDC if you choose to travel, especially out of state or on airplanes and things like that. When gathering in large groups, that would not be recommended. And it's going to be that same type of mitigation where if you're in a household with more than six people or more than people from just two separate households in one space, you should be wearing masks except for when eating, and you should really try and space out that eating over several rooms and not be face-to-face with someone across the table during any eating or drinking to really be as cautious as possible.
Let's go ahead and head to the phones. We've got Kim in Northwest Indiana. Kim, your question for Dr. Taramina.
So I was just curious. I have an autoimmune disorder, as does someone in the family that I work for. I'm wondering if people with autoimmune disorders, such as mast cell disease or Hashimoto's disorder, if it's safe for them to get this vaccine.
That's a great question. We're going to have to rely on the guidelines that come out from the ACIP, but the intention is yes, that we would want to vaccinate our most vulnerable individuals that are immunocompromised at the top of the list. Occasionally, we come out with emergency use authorization recommendations that basically say, look, we are not sure, but it appears that the benefits of potential vaccine outweigh the risks potentially possible with these vaccines. And we have to look at the numbers of individuals in the study groups that are in different categories, including immunocompromised categories, in order to render these recommendations. But the hope and the anticipation will be that, yes, aside from frontline workers and our nursing home patients, at the top of the list are going to be our immunocompromised individuals thereafter.
Oh, interesting. Thanks for that call. Next, we'll go to Ruthie in West Rogers Park. Ruthie, you're on the line.
Thank you, Dr. Taramina. I was wondering if somebody actively has COVID, can they still get the vaccine, or is it more effective if they are free of COVID at that time?
That's something that we also are waiting to hear on, but I believe the anticipation is going to be that you need to be recovered from COVID and potentially, so it should be 10 to 14 days after your COVID diagnosis before you are vaccinated. We do have certain viruses that if you vaccinate acutely during the infection, where we get some benefit from, you know, achieving immunity faster if someone has received a vaccine right when they've been acutely infected. Time will tell if we receive an indication to use our COVID vaccine in that capacity, but at this time, that's not likely to be part of the initial indication. Good question.
Dr. Taramina, I mean, with the speed in which this vaccine has come online, I mean, these are the questions that still remain that maybe, you know, if we had a longer process that we have time on our side to have more of these answers, right?
Absolutely. And that's where we have the difference between FDA approval and emergency use authorization. So the concept of an emergency use authorization is really when there's no alternative. We don't have anything else that we can do better for coronavirus in terms of the therapeutics that we have. And we have enough data, 60 plus days in with tens of thousands of individuals to establish, you know, first line, the safety, and then reasonable efficacy to come to the conclusion that the benefit outweighs the risks of delaying this further. And that's what emergency use authorization seeks to establish. So I think that more time is only going to lead us in the positive direction with more positive and more robust data. But at this point, we, similar to what has happened in the UK, we have enough information to at least apply for that emergency use because we don't have an alternative and the benefit outweighs the risks of further withholding this.
Do you think there's enough information at this point to say that there isn't much risk or minimal risk of long-term effects?
Again, it's going to be hard to tell, but what we can see is that we're not having any tremendous severe adverse reactions to the vaccine. And obviously, getting a vaccine to achieve emergency use authorization so quickly, we are going to be focused on those initial severe adverse events. And that's something that we needed to, you know, exclude and rule out and make sure that that's not a part of this, because we cannot have a dangerous vaccine come to market. We don't know about long-term vaccine effects without long-term data. And that's something that does give individuals pause. But what we do know is that the safety of these vaccines and the newer technologies are only improving upon traditional vaccine science to the point of having more robust safety intentions.
Mm-hmm. Well, we just heard from Ruthie in West Rogers Park. We're going to turn now to Ruth in Rogers Park. Ruth, you're on Reset.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call. I have a question about the safety of visiting with newborns. In my case, I have a grandson who will be leaving the NICU next week. Is it safe to visit him, or should I wait till vaccines are available, or how do you proceed?
Dr. Taramina.
These are tough questions, and I get the newborn questions all the time. I think that the safest way in order to see your grandson as soon as possible would unfortunately be to get a test and to quarantine for 14 days and to make sure that you do not develop any symptoms at all and you do not go anywhere. That way you would be more reassured that you have cleared a quarantine period and you have been tested and are negative and can effectively get out and visit your grandson. On a second tier, we do have, if we can get a test now and then still stay home for at least 5 to 7 more days after achieving that negative test, that could be at least a little bit more reassurance as well. Mask wearing, of course. I don't have any issues, obviously, with virtual visits. And if there was going to be just a casual meet and greet to stay socially distanced without a test, with a mask on and more than 6 feet away from the grandchild, getting a couple little oohs and ahs in would be okay as well.
It's always tough staying away from the children and the grandchildren.
For sure.
We've got Grace in the South Loop. Grace, you are on Reset.
Hi. I'm wondering what accommodations have been made or are being considered for elderly people. In my case, there are two of us who are octogenarians with underlying conditions, and in my case also disabilities, multiple disabilities, for receiving the vaccine, because we live not in care homes but in our own homes, condo, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, that's an interesting question, Dr. Taramina.
Yeah, Grace, you're the exact patient that we want to get this vaccine to as soon as we can. It all depends on supply and demand. So the hope would be that with not one but two vaccines coming to emergency use authorization by the end of the year and the AstraZeneca vaccine soon to follow, hopefully in early 2021, I'm hoping by February, March, right when we're coming out of this surge here, if we can just all hunker down a few more months, I'm hoping by February, March, it's going to be a more robust supply that we're going to be able to get down into the community. And at the top of the list are going to be those over age 65 with immunocompromising conditions or chronic health issues, certain chronic health issues. And then beyond that group of individuals, we will get to the healthy adults, hopefully into late spring and early summer. So we want to make sure that as soon as we have supply available for folks like yourself, that we get you those vaccines.
Let's head on over to Rogers Park. Dave has a question. Dave.
I have a question around the travel ban and test combination. So I chose not to go to a wedding out of state because of the travel ban. And I started looking at the requirements. And I thought, if I went to the wedding, I didn't, but if I did, and I traveled on a plane, I could have been exposed at that point. And if the wedding's only on the weekend and I travel on a plane to come back, there's two exposure possibilities. So if I'm following the travel ban, I'm supposed to get a negative test result before returning back into the state. If I got that negative test result before coming back, I still would not have had time to have had enough virus buildup for that actual test to be accurate. So I'm curious why there is that requirement for that negative test before returning back into the state.
It is definitely challenging. And there's some room for shorter periods of time, like business travelers that are only traveling someplace for less than 24 hours. Weekends are tough. I mean, aside from having a weekend of travel, you know, the recommendation is to get a negative vaccine documented 3 days prior to travel. But you're right. By the time you've traveled, you'd be getting another test immediately upon getting there to get a negative test before coming home. And it doesn't make a lot of intuitive sense. You know, there's definitely room to improve these guidelines. By my view, I think that the concept of getting tested 72 hours before travel, and then if it's the return flight, you know, adhering to all the guidelines and seeking, you know, testing around days 5 to 7 after that return flight. But, you know, I'm not aware of any absolute bans aside from international travel, of course, that you need to have a documented negative testing. But yeah, certainly that would present a problem.
All right. Well, let's go from the city to the western burbs. Let's go to Jane in Naperville. Jane, you have a question for the doctor.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I am a retired school teacher, and I've been watching with interest and applauding the thoughtful decisions made by school administrators, whatever their choices, to set up their schools. It seems that lately we're hearing that wide viral spread by students and staff has been lower than expected and feared. And I was wondering if Dr. Terramina has observed that in schools, students, staff follow the protocols with masking and a lot of hand washing. I, as a non-medical or scientific person, would assume that that is why it has worked well in those schools that have tried in person, even as a hybrid approach. And I just wondered what Dr. Terramina's take is on that, because out in the community, non-compliance frequently occurs because it's not a rule and people do not have to follow those rules as they do when they're in a school.
Yeah, thanks for that, Jane. Yeah, the spread has been relatively low within schools. Dr. Terramina, what do you say?
So, Jane, I have been on the side of wanting our kids back in school from the get-go. And I think that there's definitely room to really focus on getting them back after this holiday break here for those that are in full virtual models right now. And as you know, the Chicago Public Schools is planning on exactly that. We have the support of Dr. Anthony Fauci. We have the support of Dr. Robert Redfield from the CDC, and we have the support of many prominent physicians in the Chicagoland area who also are in agreement. You're absolutely correct. We've created some of the safest places in the schools by using the mitigation strategies, and we are not seeing lateral spread of this virus. There are no absolutes. There are certainly going to be protocols for potential outbreaks and protocols for potential concerns, but almost all of these children and staff members who test positive are doing so because of known exposures outside of the school. And when and if a sick child comes to school, which will happen if we open the doors, the chances of that child who's properly masked, even when showing symptoms, passing that to another masked child or masked adult are very slim. So we're just not seeing that side-to-side spread. This, coupled with the CDC's announcement that we can decrease quarantine in some cases to 7 to 10 days instead of a full 14 days, is going to be revolutionary, in my view, in getting these schools back on track, because part of the issue is having that one child come in with symptoms, knocking out an entire classroom and or staff members for 14 plus days is leading to too many people out to have the critical infrastructure to run our schools properly. So the fact that we can now revisit our protocols, not declare outbreaks within classrooms until there's more than 2 to 5 students who are positive, and get these teachers back more quickly after higher risk exposures is going to be outstanding.
That's Dr. Mia Terramina. She's an infectious disease specialist with the DuPage Medical Group, and she's answering your questions about how to stay safe with COVID-19 during this pandemic. Thanks so much, Dr. Terramina.
Thanks, Susie.
Thanks for listening to Reset. If you like what you're hearing, please take a minute to subscribe to our daily podcast below. A new episode drops every afternoon. Fridays, it's our weekly news roundup. Sundays, a COVID Q&A with Dr. Mia Terramina. We also bring you interviews on arts, culture, politics, and the latest news. I'm Susie Ahn. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you back here soon. Have you ever wondered why anyone drinks Malort? Or if there are actually lobsters in the Chicago River? Then listen to the Curious City podcast, where we answer all your questions about Chicago and the region. WBEZ's Curious City is part of the NPR network and available wherever you find your podcasts.